You're listening to Border Patrol from the Classical Music Initiative, a service of American Public Media. From San Diego, why don't we head up to Valencia and talk to James Tenney and Stephen Lucky Mosco. Tell me about them. We've kind of been talking about them all along, but why don't you go ahead and intro who these guys are?
I think they're about 10 years apart. Jim is 10 years older or so than Lucky, and they both basically grew up in Colorado. It was very interesting. I think Jim's sister went to school with Lucky, but I don't think they knew each other at the time, actually.
Did they meet at CalArts in the
I believe
70s,
so.
Early 70s when Lucky came back?
Yeah,
to,
I believe so.
To study there, actually.
I think Lucky studied with Tenney, actually, yes.
So they crossed paths at CalArts in the early 70s.
Uh-huh.
They've had such long careers. Can you give them a style or a sensibility to what their compositions are like?
I think Tenney really defies that. Tenney's music is unified really by a point of view, an aesthetic point of view, an aesthetic position that he's taking. A research problem, it could have a scientific basis. What drives all of his music, I think, is a curiosity about what it is he's working on, a particular problem that presents itself. And that might be a problem, as I said, that has its roots in science. It might be a problem that has its roots in tuning, acoustics, all of this. So what you hear in his music through the whole body of work is definitely an aesthetic point of view.
So he's not, so to speak, a scientist, but he is, if you will, a researcher.
Yes.
An explorer, yeah.
An explorer, a researcher, a pioneer.
Whose style is not to have a style.
Exactly. That's not to say that he's an eclectic composer. I don't have that sense that he's, you know, trying this, trying that. It's not a neo-anything.
But it's a body of investigations.
That's right. Yes. It's not a retrogressive point of view at all. It's very much a progressive point of view in all of the work.
Hanging,
you know, what is extraordinary to me about Tenney, too, is that any one of his pieces, just look at the body of work from the electronic music that he did in the 1960s, what research he was doing at Bell Labs, through the pieces in the 70s, mm-hmm. which are in the 80s, concerned with really the problem of harmony. Any one of those pieces could have occupied any other composer for a lifetime.
Absolutely.
But he has such insatiable, passionate curiosity in his work that you see and you hear across that just fantastic landscape of his body of work. I find that remarkable.
One thing that I think the two of them have in common, and I think that has also informed their music, is the fact that they're both interpreters of other people's music. Lucky's had a huge career all over the world conducting and working very closely with people like Steve Reich, Elliot Carter, Louis Andreessen, John Adams, the who's who of composers over the last 30, 35 years Lucky has worked with closely.
Yeah, he's a master conductor.
Closely, yeah. And James Tenney is
great
an interpreter.
Pianist. Fantastic pianist. In fact, he gave a concert about 2 months ago at his home, private get-together of mm-hmm. friends from CalArts, as I understand it, where he did the entire Concord Sonata of Charles Ives from memory.
Wow. And how long is that piece?
50 minutes.
Hmm.
And he also, Tenney was also very involved in fact, was a co-founder of a group called Tone Roads.
Correct,
back in
yeah.
the 60s, which premiered a lot of the work of Charles Ives, Carl Ruggles. These are great American experimentalist composers. Edgard Varèse.
Lou Harrison. And in a way, it's what's happening with the Turmer Flora group. They're kind of informing each other as well, coming from all their different backgrounds and styles. And now it's easier for us to look back and say, well, you know, Lucky and Tenney were with all these famous composers. But hopefully the individuals in Turmer Flora will become those famous composers.
One of the pieces we're going to hear by Jim Tenney dates from 1971, mm-hmm. entitled Never Having Written a Note for Percussion, where the performers, in this case Sonic Youth, an alternative rock and roll band, mm-hmm. engage in a single unfolding gesture. This piece is drawn from his early graphic notation experiments in which he just wrote a series of very brief instructions on postcards for the performers, and then they realized those instructions in their way.
Thank you.
We're also going to hear a 1961 piece that I notice has some sort of samplings of Elvis and some other things that kind of seems like he's three decades ahead of DJs and remixing.
Isn't it true? And this is a piece called Blue Suede Shoes, in which he transforms a 1961 tape by Elvis Presley. And it's analogous to what DJs are doing today, where you take a pre-existing sample, you deconstruct it, and then you reconstruct it and reassemble it and create a new piece out of it. And it shows a different side of Tenney, and that is a side which is... And it shows a more humorous side, I think, of Jim Tenney.
The Hollywood image of the composer, which is, in my mind, from the George Gershwin story, and I have this memory of an image of George Gershwin at the piano trying to find the next note, the right next note. And this is absolutely working from the bottom up, saying, we're going to go from the beginning to the end of this piece, note by note. Can you imagine a painter working like that? Working from the lower left-hand corner, gradually up. Fluxus was interesting, but you know, that was only one of many different things that I was involved with during the 60s. I was doing computer music at Bell Labs.
You were performing with Cage all the time.
Yes, I was conducting a chamber ensemble that we called Tone Roads.
When did Tone Roads start and where, how did
1963. That... 1963.
And what was the impulse for that?
There was music that I deemed to be really important American experimental music that was not being performed, and I wanted to hear it. I wanted to have other people hear it.
What do you think, Jim, about linearity?
As in
a compositional form of background structure.
I think it can be very interesting.
Do you use it?
Sometimes. I relate it to what has been called minimalism, where there's a process, a gradual process, that is moving in some direction, and once it's set going, it's allowed to work itself out. Mm-hmm. I've got several pieces that do that and basically do nothing more than that. But the wonderful thing about pieces like that is that even though it seems completely deterministic, in fact, the musical results are frequently surprising. For example, my piece for player piano, the Spectral Canon for Conlon Nancaro, is completely linear in that sense. It's absolutely deterministic, and yet you would not, at any point in the piece, be able to predict what it's going to be doing a minute later, because the way that process develops is beyond our ability to predict.
And is that because several things are going on at the same time against each other, so that the result of the surface is sort of chaotic, but the background is structured?
Well, in this case, it's not chaotic at all. It is completely deterministic and yet unpredictable to us. What ends up happening in some of these pieces is just quite astonishingly surprising. Steve Reich talked about gradual process.
Early on,
mm-hmm. And we had discussions about it. I said, so in this situation, the composer is not privy to the process. That is, the listener understands the process as well as the composer does. And this Steve liked.
On some level, was this a political, moral issue about morality that things should not have hierarchies but be processes?
No. I don't think it was ever a moral issue, and I don't think it has to do with hierarchy. It was, I think, just an interest in gradual process that nobody had explored really
before.
But
what's the cultural part of gradual process? Why not form? Why not ABA? Why did you switch to gradual process rather than ABA?
You're
at home, you go somewhere, you come home again. And what Jim is talking about is you're always on the road.
Well, listen, we didn't invent it. Yeah. Ravel invented it in Bolero, right?
Sure.
So there's a linear process. Right. It goes section by section. Does. Definitely, it's moving in one direction only, and only at the end did he blow it.
Did he say,
oh, that's not enough?
It was sentimental.
I've got to do something more interesting here. So he shifts the key, right?
Right.
He didn't need to. It was a perfectly functioning mechanism.
Well, doesn't it seem like, going back to your comment about movie music, he needed that modulation up one step to make the last climax?
Right, right. He wanted to say, oh, I'm still the composer.
Right. You take yourself out of your music a lot.
Sure. I mean, I'm not my music. Because my music is my music. It's not me. It's like I've always thought of it that way, that it's not a self-expressive operation. It is something that I think I want to hear, and I'm interested in making happen and having other people hear. But it only has to do with me very indirectly. It doesn't have to do with my psyche or my emotions or any of that. It's just something that I've made happen. So I do think there's an important, it's like the separation of church and state, right?
Jim, you were at Bell Labs in the early 60s. Can you talk about that?
Well, yes, it was a very important experience for me. The way it happened was that I read an article describing the new program they had developed there for generating sound with a computer. I thought it was really interesting, and I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois then, but on Christmas break, I went back to New York and called them at Bell Labs and arranged to come and visit because I really wanted to find out what was going on and understand it better. So I did that, and they were very cordial, and I spent a couple hours with them. When I went back home, I got a letter from the head of the laboratories there saying, we enjoyed your visit. We'd like to invite you to come and use our facilities. And I wrote back and I said, well, thank you very much. That's great. But right now, I hadn't graduated yet and I didn't have a job. I said, right now, I don't know where I'm going to be next year. And I got a letter back from that offering me a job at Bell Labs. It was just incredible.
Wow. Excellent.
Amazing.
And did they just turn you loose and say, do interesting stuff?
The idea of hiring me was that I would give them input about how to develop the program. All right, so one of the first things I said, well, you need a random noise generator. Right? Because they had very simple ideas. You know, there was a sine wave with a simple envelope. You know, they had like three or four parameters defining a sound. And I said, well, it's got to be more complicated than that. So we had noise, random generators, modulation, frequency and amplitude modulation, more complex envelope generators, etc. So that was what I was hired to do, was make suggestions about how to develop that program, which I did. But while I was doing it, I was making pieces.
Tell me about that Che Guevara piece.
It's called Fabric for Che. It was meant as a kind of political statement. It was like, you know, one of the ugly pieces. I wanted something that was disturbingly a texture of 10 minutes of just these bands of noise all combined and overlapped, going on like with no shape. It's stationary. It continues at the same level the whole 10 minutes.
It's very disconcerting.
Well, I hope so. It was meant to be a protest. It was done just after Guevara was killed.
So in the Guevara piece, it's sound elements that you created with the Bell Labs equipment, mm-hmm. and then you later did tape work to layer those elements together?
Yes, exactly. All of the sound had been created with the computer process at Bell Labs, but I put it together later by just mixing. Piece that Lucky mentioned, For Anne Rising, also used sounds that were generated at Bell Labs.
For Anne Rising is, it's a hard one to describe.
It's an
oral
illusion.
Like it's always going up all the time, and you don't know why it's always going up all the time, because how can anything keep going up all
forever.
The time?
Forever.
Now, Jim, you said to me years ago that when you played the piece so it went down rather than going up, it made people get sick and throw up.
No, I didn't say that.
Yes, you did. You did too.
What I said was that I found it depressing.
No, you told me people threw up.
It's another case of the exquisite.
No, here's the story. Here's the story. David Behrman was working at Columbia Records, and he heard a recording of For Anne Rising. And he went to the guy who was the head of recording at Columbia, and he said, I'd like to put this out. And that guy said, okay, that's kind of interesting, but I would like you to do it on a 45 RPM, and on the other side would be the reverse of it. So I went home and I played it backwards. I said, this is really depressing. And so I said, David, no way. We're not going to do it that way. Because when it all came down, it just, to me, was depressing.
Well, don't you think my story is better than yours?
Yes, probably.
For Anne Rising, it makes this point right away.
Well, except the end is different.
Because had to have an ending.
I hope it's not one of those Ravel cop-outs.
It is. It's a Ravel cop-out. Sorry. I hate to say it, but he copped out at the end. He made an ending. See, composers like to be good people at the end. You can do everything you want during the piece, ugly or anything, but almost all composers at the end want to say, really, I'm not a bad person.
What we're really trying to say is, I'm a good lay.
Yeah.
Jim, you stopped writing electronic music in the early 70s?
Well, I stopped when I came to California.
Really?
Because what I'd been doing in the 60s was mostly computer music.
Right.
And when I got to CalArts in 1970, they did not have that kind of system. What there was an analog synthesizer, which I had never worked with, and I'm not a knob turner. I don't work well that way.
Which is hugely popular now.
Yeah.
Suddenly.
It's fine. I mean, some people, that works for them really well, but it did not work for me. So here I was. The medium that I had been most comfortable with was not available to me. But then I looked around and noticed that I was surrounded by these incredible players. These incredible players of acoustical instruments, and that was what led to the postcard pieces. The postal pieces that are
fluxes.
Each one is for some particular player, right? And they happen to be scores that would fit on a postcard, but the essential thing about them is that they're all for live instrumental players of acoustical instruments, right? Mm-hmm. There's an evolutionary process that's going on that I like to think is exemplified by the fact that the first performance of Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire only occurred after Schoenberg had directed 120 hours of rehearsal with the best musicians in Vienna. 120 hours, and now a student ensemble from CalArts can put it together in 6 hours and play really as well as they did. So what's going on there?
I think
evolution. It's a cultural evolutionary process, which is really very interesting. And we are all involved in that. And that's a beautiful thing.
Thanks for patrolling the borders of new music with us. Bijal Shah, Nicole Nelson, and Richard Cooper provided production assistance for this broadcast. Justin Jones engineered it. Mary Lee and Lauren D. provided invaluable assistance. Border Patrol comes to you from the Classical Music Initiative. It's funded in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Additional support is provided by Mr. and Mrs. Howard Solomon. I'm Glenn Zuckman. For Martin Herman, Amy Knowles, myself, and all the artists crossing the borders of new music, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
American Public Media.